This is an ABC podcast.
There are aliens living among us. It can take us a while to realise this. And when I say aliens, I mean the animals that live all around us, particularly the ones that we invite into our homes to become our pets. I grew up in a house where there was always a pet cat, and everyone in that house projected all kinds of silly thoughts and feelings onto the cat. That's part of the pleasure of sharing your life with these animals, all the affinities that we share as living, breathing creatures. You can see how much they enjoy eating and playing and even sleeping. But sometimes there's an odd moment when an animal looks at you and you look back and you realise that this is not a creature that thinks like us at all. It has its own integrity, its own sense of itself. It's got nothing to do with how cute or adorable or clever or silly you might think it is. It can't help be anything other than utterly true to its nature, which is not human nature. And in that moment, you sometimes wonder, what am I to this animal? Today, it's a special conversations program, The Animal That Walked Into My Life. Stories about an encounter with a cat, a small monkey, a crow, a hawk, and a rare breed rabbit. And of the weird moment of insight passed on to the human being in their encounters with these fabulous creatures. John Gray is a well-known British philosopher, and he's a total cat man. Until recently, he had four cats in his life. But it was only after a rather odd conversation with a colleague that he began to wonder what it is that we see in cats and what they might see in us. I called John at his home in England.
Hello.
Hello, John. Can you hear me okay?
It's fine, thank you. It's great to talk to someone like you who knows about cats, lives with cats, and also is curious about cats.
John, you've written a book about the philosophy of cats, and it begins with a story about another philosopher you met who told you he'd persuaded his cat to become a vegan. Tell me about what you thought when you heard him say that.
Well, this was a number of years ago, Richard, and when the philosopher told me that he'd persuaded his cat to become a vegan, I naturally imagined that he was joking. So I said facetiously back to him, well, you must have had some very persuasive arguments. cats are not easily persuaded to become vegans. And he looked at me with great displeasure and annoyance. And I then realized he wasn't joking. He really did believe he'd persuaded his cat to become a vegan. I was sort of slightly baffled about how to continue the conversation, but I went on to ask, well, how has it adapted to this life? It was perfectly okay. What I was striving to get from him was how it actually adapted to a completely unnatural diet, but he seemed to think it was perfectly okay. Then it occurred to me to ask the decisive question, does the cat go out? And he replied that it did go out. And of course, then we had the solution to the mystery, which is that the cat will have undoubtedly, baffled by the behavior of the human, the human in its life, will have gone out to find another home, which cats often do, or it will have gone out to hunt. Now, if I'd been able to pursue the conversation further, I would have asked him, but that would have made him even more angry, I think. does the cat bring back trophies from its hunting expeditions, which cats often do, because, of course, it's natural for cats to hunt. And in fact, as I later discovered when I read about cats in more detail, they need certain types of protein in their diet, which can only be got by predation, by hunting, by eating meat. A vegan diet would be death to a cat. The cat knows that instinctively, so it does what it does in order to flourish as a cat. So then the conversation trailed off and it came to an end. I didn't want to prod him even more. I was actually then pondering what the cat's made of all this. And one of the deep truths about cats is that they don't attempt to make human beings more reasonable than they are. They tend to regard, I think, human beings as very odd creatures. Sometimes they can come to have affection for them, for the human beings in their lives. They can enjoy being with us, and in that sense, they can even love us. But there is different from us as we are from them. We're very different types of minds, human minds and cat minds, very different kinds of natures and creatures. And of course, for many people, that's part of the charm of living, let's say, with a cat, which is that it's a window outside of the human world. But they do regard us as definitely odd. But unlike humans, they're not crazy enough to think that they should try to instruct us in being more reasonable. They don't try and teach us how to live. If they see human beings acting unreasonably, and if that somehow affects them negatively, they leave. That was a deep feline lesson, a lesson in feline philosophy for me right back when this story actually happened.
Indeed, I suspect there's probably a whole conference for philosophers on the whole idea that you might be able to persuade a cat to become a vegan, because it implies two things, doesn't it? One is that the cat is amenable to human to arguments and persuasion.
Yes.
And the second thing is it's also amenable to an ethical discussion, that it would see the morality of a vegan diet.
Yes. Well, one of the things I say about cats is that they don't have morality in any human sense. I mean, they don't want to improve the world. They don't think that there are external rules that should govern their life. They live according to their nature. That gives them a kind of built-in ethos. And if you go back in philosophy to the ancient Greeks or to Taoism in Chinese traditions, you find a very similar idea, which is an idea that what ethics is about is living according to your nature. All creatures in the world, except humans, do that. The paradox of being a human is that we seem to be discontented with our nature. We seem to be unhappy with being the human beings that we are. And I think that's, again, one of the lessons in feline philosophy we can learn from cats, which is that they're entirely happy being what they are. They have an ethos, but as you rightly say, Richard, they wouldn't understand arguments about what we call morality. I mean, one of the experiments I try in the book is to imagine a species of cat which had all the intellectual powers necessary to practice philosophy, but was otherwise entirely feline. In other words, it was comfortable in its life, it enjoyed being the cat it was, but it also had the ability to practice philosophy. Now, I think if you explained our idea of philosophy, our idea of morality to such a cat, it would simply purr at the absurdity of it. Because even if it understood it fully, it would find it completely absurd. Because for a cat, as I say, the best life, the good life, is the life that expresses the cat's nature, the cat that it is.
One of the stories that's told of Muhammad, the prophet, is that one day he saw a kitten sleeping on his sleeve, and rather than disturb it, he cut off his sleeve rather than wake it up.
Lovely story.
It's a lovely story. What do you think that tells you about the human reaction to watching a cat basking in a square of sunshine or enjoying its sleep or being utterly itself and doing it so effortlessly too, John?
I think it's in many human beings, in cat lovers, what it does is it illuminates their life with a vision of effortless contentment. Because one of the big differences between cats and humans is that contentment, or if you like, happiness, is the default condition of cats. When cats aren't busy, when they're not hunting or playing or sleeping, they're just resting in a state of natural contentment. They always revert to that when they're not under some kind of threat or when they're not busily engaged in some of their activity. Whereas humans are possessed by a sort of diffuse anxiety or suffering, which they find it hard to explain to themselves. Our natural condition as humans is a kind of unnatural anguish, which we constantly try and escape from by activity, by plunging ourselves into the world, into business, politics, sport, romantic love, any of those things which take us away from ourselves, give us a respite from being ourselves, whereas cats are happy being themselves. So when we see a cat lying in the sun, or if a cat jumps on our lap and we don't want to move, well, I think we're responding to this vision of happiness. So it's the vision of cats are. They're a kind of natural embodiment of the happiness that we human beings are constantly seeking. They've already got it, so they don't need anything from us to tell them how to get it. If their relatively simple demands from life are met, they revert to it straight away. They're happy by nature.
I once saw someone make a joke on social media, John, that if a cat could text you, it wouldn't.
Well, actually, there is evidence that cats recognize their names when they're called out, but they just can't be bothered to respond.
I have this discussion with my wife all the time whether our cat recognizes its name, which is Buster. But I think, I suspect sometimes it just thinks that Buster means look at me. Mm. That's what they think it means, or look over here.
Yes.
Have you had that moment with a cat, and you've looked at a cat in the eye and you've gone, what a strange creature you are. There are aliens living amongst us, and you're one of them. Have you ever had that moment where the strangeness of living alongside a completely different kind of animal has suddenly struck you?
Oh, yes, very often, Richard. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I, and I think lots of other people, sounds, again, slightly strange to put it like this, but it's the alienness of cats, their difference, deep differences from us, which give them their healing power and give them their charm and their beauty to us. Because of all the animals that humans have lived with or domesticated, although cats weren't really domesticated, they domesticated us rather the other way around. But of all the animals we live with, cats, I think, are the least, among the least, and perhaps the very least, certainly compared with dogs, liable to become part human. They remain completely different. So it is as if when a cat looks in your eye, looks at you, and or you look back, it's as if it's an exchange between aliens that somehow both at the same time recognize their deep differences from each other. And yet, at the same time, if you live with a cat for a long time, the last of my feline companions, Julian, had a very happy life. When Julian lay on his back and stretched his paws out, that's a sign of happiness, because they're exposing their furry tummy to you, so it means they trust you. When he looked at me, there was kind of the puzzlement which cats never entirely get over about how strange human beings are to them. But there was also a sense of, I know this human being, he has his good sides, I even enjoy, to some extent, being with him. So they can get to know us, they can, in their way, get to love us. But at bottom, and this is the paradox of cats, they are very different from us, and they don't ultimately need us. So that's one of the things, a very paradoxical lesson for humans, again, which is that one can love another creature without basically needing it. And that's very strange to humans, because we connect love and need together. But that's the way cats love us, I think.
You said earlier that we haven't domesticated cats. They have domesticated us. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, historically, I think that's pretty much what happened. If you go back 12,000 years to when cats and humans started to live together, it seems to have been the cats that spotted the emergence of granaries, and they spotted the granaries as reliable sources of rodents, which they went in and killed and ate. And then they seem to have started living with humans. And of course, they have practical uses for humans, which they can offer them as part of the deal, so to speak, of mutual cohabitation. They're great pest controllers when they're interested, and that's part of what happened when they then started traveling around the world on ships and spread all over the world. So that's what they've done practically for us. But I don't think actually that it's the practical uses of cats which explain their ability to domesticate us. The deal they've offered is more profound, which is that they've taught us to love them. They've taught us to value their company for its own sake. They can acquire food and protection from humans, care from humans, even if they don't act as pest controllers. And in fact, they're not always that good at pest controllers or even interested in pest control. There are photographs of cats sitting with mice running around them and showing not the slightest interest in them. So they have this capacity which they sometimes use, but what they really offer us is themselves, and they've, by persuading us to love them, they've been doing the persuading, though not by arguments, but just by their very presence. By persuading us to love them, they've set up this feline-human relationship, which is so interesting and profound, because in it you see what humans really want that they can't get from other humans or themselves. Humans actually are not happy entirely in a human world. They need respite from being, relief from being human. We do, I do, we all do, I think, if we admit it. And what they get from cats is that relief. And cats instinctively understand what they're giving us. They're giving us this image, this reality, actually, this embodied reality of happiness.
John, one of the Twitter accounts I follow is the Twitter account for Larry the Cat that lives at number 10 Downing Street.
Oh, yes.
And when you see photos of him or footage of Larry sort of pouring around, he's a pretty ordinary looking moggy. And a British Prime Minister or any kind of person might feel awed by the aura of power and history that surrounds number 10 Downing Street. But
yes.
Larry takes it pretty well in his stride. Larry can sit there with the world's media snapping away at him and lick his hind leg. And there's something in that. Why do we like to watch Larry licking his hind leg in front of number 10 Downing Street, do you think?
I think Larry is such a wonderful figure for all us cat lovers because he reveals the smallness, the inconsequence of the human world. The human world to Larry is a series of slightly boring-sounding meetings, exchanges, people going in and out. You can't see the point of it. Neither can we humans, actually, when we think of many of these meetings. And if you've ever attended very important meetings or talked to groups of politicians, you can't find it a less instructive experience than spending that time with a purring cat, because you certainly get something definite from the purring cat. You get the sensation of well-being. So Larry reminds us of the inconsequence or even the absurdities of human life and maybe reconciles us. It reminds us of our own insignificance, which far from being an unwelcome or an anxiety-provoking thought, I think it's one that makes us feel more peaceful. And the thing that cats do bring to us is a kind of peace that human beings rarely give each other or discover in themselves by themselves. Cats can do it just by appearing in our lives and staying there for a while. Humans find it very hard. And it's partly, of course, that we try to will ourselves into a sort of peacefulness. We try to practice various kinds of therapy or religious or other belief which will reduce our anxieties. Sometimes they work for a while, but cats don't need to do any of that. They just radiate peace.
John Gray's newest book is called Feline Philosophy, Cats and the Meaning of Life. Justin Hamilton is a comedian and an author. Justin had a bunch of gigs lined up for 2020, but when COVID struck, they all just evaporated. And he found himself in lockdown, spending long days at home, alone, in his inner city apartment. Weeks of isolation went by, and Justin became a kind of castaway, marooned in his own apartment, feeling himself going a bit mad. Then one day, an interloper appeared on his balcony.
This week, I made a new friend. At first, I didn't notice him. That's how it is with most friendships and relationships. You don't notice that person until they've been hanging around for a while. They don't get in the way of you physically or emotionally. They're just there, on the periphery, filling in the gaps of your view. At some point, they say something that tickles your fancy, and you file that throwaway comment to think about later. Eventually, you have an opportunity to talk without distraction. It is at this point you begin to bond and actively seek each other out. That's how most long-term friendships begin. Lifelong pals. Passionate love affairs. As per usual, I didn't notice him at first. And then from the balcony I heard, "Ah! Oh! Oh!" Sitting on the railing of my balcony was a crow the size of a toddler that had never rejected a snack. He looked at me and moved his head to one side and then back again. I was laying on the lounge, wondering if there was any point to wearing clothes. I looked over at the crow, who appeared to be staring at me through the window. It was at this point I thought, it definitely was a day to get dressed. A few seconds later, I returned from my bedroom dressed in shorts and a t-shirt, with the crow still sitting there staring intently into my abode. I felt like he was calling to me to come out onto the balcony. Do crows get lonely? I had no idea. I only know a little bit about crows, some random facts at best. I know that crows have their own language, that they're considered smarter than chimpanzees, that they make their own tools, that you can make friends with crows just by feeding them, and if you do, they'll bring you presents in return. Crows have been recorded watching a stoplight turn green and then throwing a walnut onto the road for a car to drive over and crack open. When the light returns to red, they know that the traffic will stop so they can fly down and pick up their tasty treat. I wandered over to the tinted screen door and slowly slid it open, the glare of the autumn sun causing my pupils to involuntarily reduce to the size of pinpricks. I shook off the light and popped my head out to look at the crow, who moved back and forth on his legs like he was warding off a crab. His head moved sporadically, a missing frame in a reel of film, the type you attribute to old news footage of Don Bradman. I gave the crow a head nod, as if we were in rival gangs. "Hello," I said. I asked him how his day was, and he answered. I wondered what he thought of the current situation, and he gave me a response that was surprisingly forthright. I asked him if he was hungry, and he shook me off. "There's plenty to eat out here," he answered. "Besides, you're a vegetarian, and if I'm going to get any food from your kind, I would prefer it was some tasty meat." "All right, no need to get bitchy," I replied. He hopped around the railing a little closer and looked me up and down. He was certainly unimpressed by my NBA shorts and black t-shirt ensemble, but as I pointed out to him, I did this all in a hurry since he was staring at me while I was in the nude, a dirty, peeping Tom. Once I pointed this out, the crow thought about what I had to say and then leaned his head back. At least he saw the funny side. We chatted for a little while longer, and then suddenly we both heard another crow nearby calling out to the suburb. We looked at one another for a moment, and then, without warning, he leapt into the air and flew away. I watched him soar above the tree across the road, and then up and over the buildings and out of view. I've been fascinated by animals all my life, and especially in recent weeks. There was the groundhog who stood on the safe side of a door and watched the dogs watching him eat a slice of pizza. What about the translucent creature that is thought to be the largest animal ever discovered living off the coast of Australia? Wales has turned out to be a hot spot for animals to make forays into areas they'd usually avoid. From the sheep at McDonald's to the Kashmiri goats wandering the consonant-heavy roads. Closer to home, we've seen kangaroos hopping down the main streets of our cities, finally fulfilling the presumptions most Americans have of our country. What must the animals be thinking as we hide in our homes away from the world? Are they enjoying the peace and quiet? Do they get together and make bold plans for what they perceive as this post-human world? Do they know something we don't? Do they hope that the worst predator this planet has ever seen is on the way out? Personally, I like the idea that they're having a laugh and sharing tasteless jokes at our expense. The next day, I was stepping out to grab a coffee when I heard my feathered friend nearby. I walked around the corner, and there he was, standing on the sidewalk, talking at a chef who had his head down, texting on his phone with one hand while a cigarette burned away in the other. The crow was acknowledging the distance rules, but only just. He kept at the chef, who continued to stare at his phone. I called out, "Hey, I think he's talking to you." The chef looked up and replied, "I think he's telling me off." "No shit. He's probably telling you to get off the phone so you can have a little chat. I'm certain that crow has more fascinating takes on the world than whoever was texting on the other side." By the time I returned with my steaming coffee, the chef was still staring down at his phone, and the crow was long gone. I haven't seen anyone I know in over 5 weeks. I hope the crow comes back to my balcony. I'm up for whatever interesting thoughts he wants to share.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Paul Carter is an author and a former oil rig worker who lived for months at one point in the jungles of Borneo in a ramshackle air-conditioned bungalow, along with his pet monkey, a little macaque named Joe. Joe spent half his time living in the jungle like a normal monkey, but while hanging around Paul's house, Joe started to take on human attributes and all kinds of human vices. Joe took up smoking and listening to music and watching aerobics Oz-style on satellite TV. But when Paul took Joe into his care as a baby, he was without a mother and barely alive.
I mean, he could sit in the palm of your hand. He was just like a little, looked straight from Middle Earth, this little bag of skin with a head. It was sort of really pathetic. So we went to the veterinary centre and came back to our staff house in the jungle with 6 months' worth of monkey baby formula and a bot thing and a pillowcase arrangement. So he's got this. And he grew up. And of course, hit monkey puberty and commenced masturbating 20 times a day, got into speed metal, he started smoking. We didn't encourage that, obviously. But, you know, if he sees someone with a cigarette, he'll launch from a rafter, from a tree, and he'd take your cigarette and go and perch somewhere and puff and, and cough. And of course, he got addicted to nicotine.
So how big did Joe grow as a macaque?
He standing up straight, I guess he was maybe a foot and a half. So I literally had a monkey on my back for 3 years because, you know, the monkey picks you, not the other way around.
There was a time when you came back home to your house in the jungle in Brunei after having been away on the rig for God knows how long, and it was just you and Joe in the house. Explain to me how that can be a difficult proposition when you're living with a monkey with a bit of an imagination.
Yeah, he's a good boy. He would take care of himself while we were away. But this particular drilling campaign called Iron Duke was kicking off, and all the guys were on different rigs, just rig hopping from rig to rig to rig to rig. We didn't see dry land for... And I got back off the rig, and the jungle would eat the house if we were away for a long time. So you literally had to hack your way to get to the front door, turn the generator on, and I dump my offshore bag, all the contents into the washing machine, and pad down the hallway, naked, got into the bathroom. Because you have to remember that when you're working on a drilling rig offshore, you know, privacy is non-existent. So it's like living inside Tupperware. So just the notion of being able to sit on the toilet without anybody in front of you bathing. So it was nice to sit there, and the door on this toilet was, the whole house was built from bits of other houses, and it was a front door. It was a great big teak front door from some property, and it didn't line up properly with the door jamb. There was a gap about 3 inches where the floor met the bottom of the door, and I heard Joe, he'd obviously heard me start the generator and now thought, daddy's home, you know, and he was chattering. I could hear him looking for me, and eventually figured out I was on the bog, and his face appeared at the gap at the bottom, and he was chattering, and I thought, oh, house, he just wanted a cigarette, man. He just wanted a smoke. So I'm chatting, and we played a game. I got a bit of toilet roll, and I jiggled it about under the gap, and his little hairy hand would, he'd try and grab it, and I'd pull it away, and yeah. That's how I amuse myself. Anyway, he jumped up on the door handle, and this was an old-fashioned door, and it had a big old brass key, and the key was on the outside. I don't know why, but he turned the key in the lock, right, and fucked off with the key. So I'm sat on the toilet.
So right. your monkey has locked you in from the outside into your toilet slash bathroom, in other words.
Correct. Yeah, correct. This is a remote location in the middle of nowhere, and this toilet is a concrete box. There's no doors other than that door, which opens inwards. It's not like I could kick the door out. It was solid teak that opened inwards.
Was there anyone else in the house?
No, and no one was due back for I don't know how long, weeks maybe. And I'm panicking at this point, realizing I'm in serious trouble.
You could starve to death in this place.
And I'm naked.
And you're naked.
And the air conditioning's on. So I'm thinking, I'm working the timelines, you know. I'm like, what can I eat? I can drink. There's nothing to eat.
Well, you're screaming at your monkey at this point.
Oh, I tried everything. Seriously, I got the shower curtain off the rail. I stuck it under the gap under the door and tried bribing him. I thought if I could just distract him with something, he'll drop the key and I can, you know, pull the curtain through and grab it. Nah. I could hear him channel surfing. He'd already turned the television on, beating things with the key. I could hear him hitting things with it. Fourteen hours later, right? I'm getting ready to cry myself to sleep in the bath. I think this is me. It doesn't matter what I do in my life. I'm just going to be the guy that died because he was locked in the toilet by his own monkey.
That's a stupid way to die, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Awful way to die.
Mum would not be impressed.
No, you'd be terrified by the obituary alone. Did you ever hear about Paul? Well, he was locked into a bathroom and died in there by his own monkey.
He's that Muppet who got locked in the toilet by his own
monkey. How long were you in there for?
14 hours.
14 hours. And how did you get out eventually?
Eventually, it wasn't a Bear Grylls moment. To keep warm, I ran a bath, right? I was sat in a warm bath, and I'm staring at them. The pins in the hinges that held the door on, I took the steel rings that held the shower curtain on and slowly hit them with the cover of the cistern behind the toilet until they were straight, and then I managed to knock the pins out of the hinges.
So there you are, naked and cold and furious.
Yes.
So once you knocked the door down,
yes.
Did you go hunting for Joe after that?
Yeah, I staggered into the hallway. I'm all bloody and covered in. I mean, I'd taken all the skin off my fingers, both hands, knocking these pins out because they've been in there since like 1955. I stagger out. The whole door comes off the frame. I stagger out into the hallway, and he's like on aerobics os style, you know. And he sort of saw me, dropped the key, bang, he's out through the door. Didn't see him for a week.
Oh dear.
Paul Carter is the author of several best-selling books, including his memoir called Don't Tell Mum I Work on the Rigs. She Thinks I'm a Piano Player in a Whorehouse.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Helen MacDonald is a British author who always loved birds of prey. As a teenager, Helen kept a pet kestrel, which flew all around the house. And this was something that her dad encouraged in her. But when her dad died, Helen was shaken to the core with terrible grief. And she decided to shut herself away from people and the world and to live alongside a goshawk. The goshawk is the fiercest, wildest bird of prey in Britain. Helen called her goshawk Mabel, and the two of them spent days together hunting in the fields around Cambridge. And after the hunt, they would share the kill, with Helen cooking and eating the prey. And in the evening, they'd watch TV together. When Helen first clapped eyes on Mabel, she was overcome by her bristling, charismatic wildness.
Oh, it was astonishing. She was a bit like gold falling through water. She was like a marionette, like a dragon. You know, she was extraordinary. And these amazing, at this point, when they're young, they have white eyes with black pupils, and they look like, you know, when sun falls on paper, they're kind of glowing like that. But she was scared of me. So I had this enormous sense of compassion and worry about her rather than of, you know, anything else.
How do you start? Where? How do you even begin to train a goshawk?
Well, it's kind of like a bit of a rite of passage, really. You start off in the dark. You keep the hawk with you all the time in the house. You put a perch on the floor in your front room. You're always around it. And that just gets them used to you very, very, very quickly. But initially, the first few days, there are always a very delicate dance of manners. So what you do is you start off with in a darkened room that sort of keeps the hawk a little bit less frightened than if, obviously, if you had bright, wide-open windows and people going past. And you sit there with a bit of raw meat in your gloved left hand, and you have the hawk sitting on top of it. She's wearing leather straps around her legs called jesses that you hold onto because you don't want her, obviously, crashing around the room and hurting herself. And then you just wait for the bird to eat. You know, it's all very, very gentle. And, you know, initially the bird is so frightened of you. I remember Mabel, I could hear her blinking. You know, I was trying not to, you don't want to look them in the eyes because that's quite a threatening thing to do. So you're very humble and very quiet. And yet this bird is sitting there and it feels like it's made, it's like a sort of, I don't know, like a flaming torch. You know, it's sort of so full of life. And then one day, you know, eventually the hawk will bend down and start to eat. And that's the first step on that long journey towards absolute trust and a bond between you both.
Yeah. So you're sitting there in the dark with this hawk, not looking at her.
Yeah.
Is she looking at you?
Yeah, she's staring at you with all the feathers on her head raised in a kind of, you know, what the hell is this? I mean, there's enough light for her to see by, you know. And there was an extraordinary moment that day, later on that day when I was holding her, when she started looking around the room. I was no longer so frightening that she couldn't stop looking at me. And she started looking at kind of the corner of the bookcase and the curtains and a bit of the television. And then she turned back and she saw me and she jumped. She'd forgotten that I was there. And that was a really great moment. It was a moment when I realized that I was not as frightening to her as I had been earlier. So there's this very incremental sense that the bird stops being frightened of you and begins to like you because every time you see it, you know, you give it food.
And how does she take the meat from your hand the first time? Does she waddle over or does she fly down to it?
No, she was sitting on my hand. I was really cross, actually. You know, I had all this kind of, there's all this sort of hush, this meditative darkness with the bird. But actually, she ate for the first time. I was sitting with her on my fist with holding steak under her toes while watching LOLO, the terrible, you know, program on telly with my friend Christina. You know, she come round and I thought, what the hell? And the bird started eating and I thought, no, this isn't right, you know. Not while LOLO was on. You know, sort of, this is a whole, you know, jokes about giant sausages and the occupation of France and my goshawk starts feeding and it was all very, 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 very disconcerting. Yeah. So she was always, oddly enough, she was a very, very disconcerting hawk. She wasn't as wild and as frightening and as, there was no great battle in her training. She was a complete sweetheart.
What was the scent of the room like with her in it?
Yeah, they have this amazing breath. Oh god, this sounds so weird, doesn't it? I remember reading once a falconer saying that Lalique should bottle the scent of hawks in and put it in sort of little glass jars.
Why? What is it? Can you compare it to anything?
It smells like sort of pepper and musk and kind of burned stone. It's a really weird sort of feral smell. It's lovely.
And did it impregnate the house? This
no, scent? But her poos did, basically. Oh. Or as they call them in falconry terminology, mutes. I was very, basically what happened is I had this huge vinyl tablecloth on the floor. It was green with white spots and the perch was on it. And I used to have to wipe it all up every morning.
And in those hours you're spending with Mabel in the house, was it a relief to be focused so intently on another thing that wasn't you?
Yes. And that was the big hook early on. It was an enormous distraction, you know, and I'm sure any listeners who've trained animals know that what you do to understand what an animal is thinking is watch it very, very carefully. And you start to understand its body language and slowly you kind of almost start to think that you can know what it's thinking or even feel what it's thinking yourself. And soon I kind of forgot I was me at all. And I started to feel that I was the hawk, which was a really, really intense and strange experience. And what I wanted to happen, I didn't want to be me anymore. I didn't want to feel sad or broken or grieving. I just wanted to be like a hawk. I wanted to be completely solitary. I wanted to be self-possessed. I wanted to live in a total eternal present. And also I felt a kind of, you know, that murderous rage that people feel after losses. You know, that it was all there and I saw it all in Mabel. And I kind of wanted to be her. And it was a very weird transference that went on.
You wanted to be her?
I did, yeah.
And did you think... But you can't, can you? I mean, in a spiritual sense, I don't think you can, because her nature is never going to be like your nature, or could it? I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I talk about this amazing anthropologist called Rane Vilislev, who went off to Siberia and worked for a while with the Ukage people who do a lot of hunting of caribou and reindeer. And they do it by assuming the sort of furs, and they wear the head, the antlers, and they kind of dress as the caribou. But they don't just dress as, and they kind of take on part of the caribou's soul, they say, when they hunt them. And what you do, if you do that, you go out into the snow, the caribou recognize you as one of their own, and they come towards you. This obviously doesn't end well for that particular caribou. But that's how it felt. I felt like I was... I felt like I was kind of transforming into her. And of course I wasn't in reality, you know, it's always in my imagination, but I started to behave very much like her. You know, I'd hide from people if I saw them walk past the window. It was all a very weird experience.
Did you adopt her daily practices, like the way you ate, or did that change the way you ate?
Yeah, I used to, I became, you know, when she was actually flying and hunting, you know, I'd go out with her every day and watch her fly and hunt, and I'd come home covered in kind of thorn scratches and mud, and I didn't wash my hair for, you know, weeks on end, and I used to either stuff myself, you know, with the food and then sort of sleep or not eat at all, and, you know, it was a weird, weird time.
It was so close to you.
We felt like the same kind of organism. I mean, it sounds so bonkers, doesn't it? But that's how it was.
You mentioned she would catch like rabbits and pheasants. Tell me what that was like to watch her do that.
I guess using the word interesting isn't enough, but it was deeply, deeply serious. So she caught a pheasant, the first thing she caught, and I ran up and I didn't know how I was going to feel about this. I felt very strongly that my hawk would have to catch things and I'd let her hunt. And I think having a hawk and not letting it hunt is like having a child and not letting it play. You know, hunting is what hawks are made of. So I ran up and Mabel had this pheasant. And unfortunately, goshawks are very, very powerful, and when they catch things in the wild, they just start eating. They've immobilised whatever it is instantly. And of course, at some point in their eating, this poor thing is going to die. So I just, you know, I had to get in there and put this poor pheasant out of its misery. And then something weird happened. I just felt very, very, very sad. I felt sad for the pheasant. I felt sad that my dad wasn't around. And I started plucking this pheasant for Mabel and helping her eat. It was like she was a child suddenly.
So you weren't exulting in it or anything?
Not at all.
You weren't enjoying the blood sport?
No, there was never any of that. There was never any bloodthirstiness. And the weird thing was that as those days and weeks and months sort of went on, and I lost myself in the hawk's flight, and every time she flew, I felt like I was an animal, you know, I felt part of this landscape. But every time she caught something, I felt incredibly accountable and responsible for its death. And I guess it made me think too that we don't really see death anymore. You know, it's behind walls, whether it's people or animals, you know, we just don't see it. And it was a real, you know, that mystery that I was talking about earlier, that puzzle that something can be alive and then not. That was, you know, I was seeing that every day.
Did you figure out that puzzle?
Yeah, we're just not here very long. We only have a finite time here, and it was something that I hadn't quite reconciled.
You must have known that, but known it.
There's a difference between knowing something and feeling it, you know. There's a lot of things I sort of worked out that year that I felt in my stomach, you know, rather than in my head. And I think that realization that we're only here for a bit of time was one of them.
Given that you wanted to share her prey, was it hard to get her off the prey so you could take the prey and bring it home strip it?
It was quite easy. There's a sort of trick that you do to start with where you sort of end up sort of throwing bits of grass, lumps of grass over it to hide it, and then offer her a bit of food in your glove and she jumps onto your glove. But eventually she'd almost step off, you know, because, you know, and then we sort of, obviously she'd have her bit raw, and I'd cook my bit later.
What kind of dish?
Well, I mean, I was pretty poor that year. I had very little money, so it was quite handy having a goshawk. And there were some pretty dodgy meals, right? I mean, I remember I used to haunt the reduced section of the local supermarket. I remember one vividly had a meal of stale crumpets and stewed rabbit. That was pretty grim, actually.
Did she always come back to you when you called her?
Yeah, there were a couple of times later. So I had this revelation later on that year that I'd got things a bit wrong. I'd gone too far into the wild. And then after that, I started flying her in a much more relaxed manner, with the result that she ended up sort of disappearing quite often going hunting on her own. And I'd have to sort of run around and follow her.
Would she stay up in the tree while you tried to call
There was a couple of times like that, yeah.
And you
get
furious?
No, furious? I just rolled my eyes at myself. It was my fault always.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you're learning to become quite patient then. Patience is
one of the big things that falconry teaches you, is how to be patient. And not just patient with the animal, but patient with yourself. It teaches you can make mistakes and you just have to take a deep breath and think, okay, I've done that wrong, you know, what's next? And patience is one of the things my dad always used to try and teach me. You know, I was a very impatient, fidgety child. And when we used to go out bird watching with him, and he'd be like, if you want to see something very much, you just have to be patient and wait. And I used to, oh, whatever, Dad, you know. But you know, it's a big lesson that. You do feel inside the animal's world. You do feel hypervigilant. Everything you see feels different from when you just look at it from a distance. You know, that sort of when you were a kid and it's your birthday the next day and you can't sleep. And it's that kind of a sense that something is happening that is buoyant and extraordinary and exciting that you can't control. It's not joyous. It's just very, very different. I can still sort of slip into it now. If I go out for walks, quite often I'll see a rabbit bouncing around and suddenly I'll snap back into that kind of old, very old way of apprehending a landscape that I, you know, that I had that year.
What happened to Mabel? You had to leave Mabel behind at some point.
No, why? I don't. So I flew her for a good few more years. But alas, a couple of years ago, she died very suddenly of a fungal infection called aspergillosis, which is it's a real bane of goshawks. And it kills a lot of wild goshawks too. And it was very sudden and sort of struck out of the blue. And I miss her to bits. I really do.
This is a fresh grief, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another grief. Was it a profound grief again? Or what did that knock you off the socks, or were you better with it?
No, I was just very, and I still am, just very, very sad she's not around. I think that year really did teach me that, you know, things disappear. We all disappear eventually. And I think that, you know, Mabel, I was just sad. I wasn't stricken with deep grief. I just miss her. There'll be other big losses in my life, I'm sure, and they will be awful. But I think I'm ready for them in a way that I hadn't been before.
Helen MacDonald's book about Mabel is called H is for Hawk, and her new book is called Vesper Flights. Finally, a journey into the heart of animal darkness with a floppy-eared bunny rabbit that came into the life of actor and author William McInnes's family. The rabbit, a rare breed French rabbit, just appeared one day without warning, in front of his home in Melbourne.
It was on the nature strip, and there was this great big white rabbit. It was a big furry animal, and had these great big droopy ears. And we were just doing something out the front, I think dropping someone off, and my daughter went, "Daddy, there's a bunny, can we keep it?" And I said, "There's no rabbit out here." And there was this thing. It was a massive rabbit.
What, on the nature strip?
Yeah.
Like a magic creature or something?
It was that big.
Right.
And I said, "Oh, well, we'll take it in. If no one, we'll put a couple of messages on the telegraph poles around the electricity poles around the suburb."
Lovely, yeah. Fluffy rabbit.
This thing was a psychopath. It was a French lop. It was like a Hannibal Lecter unleashed from the hockey mask. It was like Magneto on a bad day.
Why? Why? What'd it do?
Well, it was just malevolent. It was like it scratched the bejesus out of you, you know?
Did you have a name for it?
We called it Mr. Snowy, I think we called it, which sounds like a serial killer. Anyway, I thought, we're going to keep it, great. And it would burrow out. And we put it in a hutch. It had just pushed the hutch along trying to get out. It was like something out of some laboratory. Like, I think it came from a CSIRO place. Anyway, I sort of took it up to the local vet, who's a great guy. He's sort of, "Oh, how you doing, mate? You okay like that?" And I said, "Paddy, what can you do for me?" He said, "What is it?" "Oh, it's a rabbit." And I said, "What are they?" It's a French lop, Bill. I said, "What can you do, Paddy?" "They're buggers of things, Bill." I said, "What can you do?" "Can cut its nuts off for you." I went, "Okay, you do that." And if anything, he just went completely troppo after that. Every time he saw me, he just sort of tried to lunge at me. And then one day...
Do you think... Are you saying This rabbit blamed you.
I reckon he did. He had those pink red eyes. You know, how you think you got red eye camera. It was like a laser. It was like a mutant rabbit.
It blamed you for its neutering.
Yes.
It blamed you.
Yeah, and then the kids went off it. Even Stella went off it. She said, Mr. Snowy's awful. Mr. Snowy. Well, I put it on a lead once to see what would happen because I saw in a magazine, a pets magazine, that they had some pop star had a weasel on a rabbit.
A leash.
That's the video I was watching the other night. No, a leash, yeah. Because I seeing the ferret on a leash. So I put this thing on the, and it was bouncing around, running at me. It was awful. But then one afternoon, there was a... Hello, have you seen this rabbit? I said, yes, it's in the back. It's in my backyard. And it was like, she was so astounded that it was like, you know, this is the crazy guy who pretends to have my pet rabbit at the back so he can attack me and lock me up in the cellar. I said, I'll go get it. And I actually took about 15 minutes trying to catch the bloody thing and yelling out to her, just wait there, I've got it. And I brought this thing. I gave it to her and she goes, snowflake. And I went, whoa, no wonder he's so angry, he's a big snowflake. And then she said, he's a breeding rabbit. I went, not anymore. And then Clem said, didn't we catch? No, we didn't, mate. It's all right. Don't worry about that. And so she sits in a car, and it was a Peugeot. I was thinking, only a Peugeot driver would have a French breeding rabbit. And she held up this rabbit, and she waved its paw at me. It sort of stared at me. And I tell you, if it had a gun or a knife in its hands, it would attack me. It sort of went like that. It sort of bared its big teeth. I don't know what happened to him, but it was like, I've still got scratches on my wrist somewhere.
Actor and author William McInnes. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.